This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The movement toward open adoptions began in the 1970s, and today the majority of babies adopted domestically will have some kind of contact with their birth parents. Still, four decades in, many families continue to wrestle with how open is too open. While kids who know their birth mother or father don't have to wonder where they came from, there are stories about birth parents suddenly dropping out of the picture and the child having to figure that one out. And for all the adults involved, there can be some boundary issues that have to be worked on. Meanwhile, for children from other circumstances, those adopted internationally or older kids from foster care, little or no contact with their birth parents still seems to be the norm. This hour on The Exchange, what adoption looks like today and how it's changed. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Your questions, comments, and of course, personal stories are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. With us in studio is Kelly Smith, therapist and consultant working with foster and adoptive families. Kelly has worked in the field for 25 years, and Kelly, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Great, thank you.
Also with us, Matt Mowry, adoptive father of two sons. Matt's also the editor of Business NH Magazine. And Matt, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you too.
And also with us, Caroline Glennon, manager of adoption services for the nonprofit Child and Family Services of New Hampshire. Caroline's worked in this adoption field for 28 years, and Caroline, it's good to meet you. Thank you also for your time.
Oh, pleasure to be here.
Well, Caroline, I want to start with you. You know, we're going to talk this hour about modern adoption, what it looks like, the range of experiences that families have. But just remind us, Caroline, how it used to be not that long ago in the 50s and 60s, maybe even early 70s.
Oh, at one time, adoption was so secretive. Birth parents were ashamed of the situation they were in. Adoptive parents were scared about not being able to get pregnant. The whole process was secretive and scary. And I would say the biggest change, having lived through it now, occurred, I would say, even a little bit later, more in the late 80s and early 90s. That's when birth mothers really started to take control of the situation and become a big part of picking adoptive parents. And when I first started at Child and Family Services, so it was the late 80s, we were still, the social workers were the ones picking the families for the children, for the babies. And what a wonderful feeling that was for us. I mean, it was, you know, joyous picking out the right family and seeing that family come together. But that was not right. The way it should have been was, the birth parents should have been participating. And it was right around that time that birth parents asked for that. And we jumped right in and moved with that movement and started with adoptive parents writing profiles and not having pictures and not, you know, saying their last names or anything, but just writing a little profile and having the birth mother look at several of them and say, oh, this is a wonderful family, or that's a wonderful family. This is the one I choose. That has grown. So over the years, it has grown to birth mothers looking at more profiles, and the profiles include pictures, and many of the profiles now have last names. People aren't afraid anymore. Birth parents aren't ashamed. Adoptive parents are more open to the openness, and I think we're going to talk more about that. What was once very scary with counseling can be the most wonderful way to do your adoption.
Well, it's so interesting how it has changed, and certainly movies and literature, Kelly, are full of stories about, you know, young women going to a nunnery, having the baby. It's all very hush-hush secret and so forth. I wonder what you think about what Caroline said.
I absolutely agree. I've worked with birth moms who had placed their children up for adoption 20, 30 years ago, and they still live in that loss and that shame and that secrecy. So it's really, we're in a different place today. Today it's about respect and honor and honesty and really working together as a team for that baby.
What led to that change? What do you think?
I think it's a combination of birth moms feeling empowered and having a voice. And I also think it's adoptees, as they were growing up, saying, wait a minute, there's a piece of my story that's missing. And I deserve to know my story. And I deserve to know what happened. So I think those are the two factors that changed.
Well, and also maybe just in terms of knowing so much about our health history and how it's related to our genes. And, you know, maybe you want to know what your genes look like.
I think that's important for an adult adoptee, but I say right. all the time in a class that I teach that my kids don't ever want to know what blood type they have.
No.
They want to know what did she look like, and did she like strawberry ice cream, and did she or he play soccer? That's what kids want to know. You know, when we're adults, we want to know the boring stuff like heart disease and diabetes. But my kids just want to know where they came from.
Absolutely. Well, again, the number for you to join us today as we look at adoption now and how it's changed is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Matt Mowry, it's so good to have you here. What's your adoption story? Just remind us.
Sure. So my wife and I became foster parents 3 years ago, and we were intending to adopt one child. And about a day after we got licensed, we got an email from the state agency going, we know you're looking at one, but we have these two brothers, and we were looking to foster to adopt, and that's where their case was going. And we met them on what I would say is the weirdest blind date you're ever going to have. And fell in love with them. And, you know, within a week, they were in our house. And we're happy to say that about a year and a half ago, we were lucky enough to become their parents.
So you took them in as foster kids with the hope of adopting.
Yes.
And is that a tricky situation? I mean, there's a, you know, sometimes foster kids are reunited with their biological parents once their biological parents get their act together, so to speak.
Right. And that's, you know, in New Hampshire, our state is dedicated to that, that the first intention when a child comes into foster system is to see if there's a way to reunite the family, to resolve the issues that are going on in the family. Our children had been in the foster system for 9 months at that point. We were their third foster home, and they were 2 and 4 at the time. So
wow.
Our youngest had spent almost half his life in foster care at that point. They had been reunited with mom at one point. Unfortunately, there was an issue that happened that required that they be removed from the home again. And that's when we came in the picture. And so they knew we were looking to foster adopt. It appeared that their case was going to go that way. But there was still a lot of that happened during that time. And during that time, we did have instances where there's two different dads. And so both dads had been out of the picture. But we had times where each father expressed an interest in adopting or taking their child, which was traumatic on a lot of different levels for us. One, we were bonded with these children, and
right,
the thought of losing them into people that our kids didn't even know was anxiety producing. And then the other thing that was heartbreaking for us is that the only consistent relationship these two children had in this whole time was each other. And they didn't have the same dad. So if a father had been able to take their child back, it would have required splitting these two brothers up and to this. So there was a lot of emotions that went along the way, you know, due to different circumstances. None of the parents were able to really step up to the plate to parent their child. And at the end of the day, their parental rights were either severed or given up. And then after that, our adoption was able to take place. But yeah, along the way, there's a lot of emotional roller coasters that you go through as a foster family.
Well, and a roller coaster in the whole adoption process. That's the word that a lot of people use when they describe what it's like to adopt a child with a wonderful happy ending like Matt's. But I'd love your thoughts too, Caroline, on the roller coaster and what's involved in it.
Oh, it is a roller coaster for sure. Adoptive parents, when they're searching for how they're going to adopt, they have to make a lot of decisions. For instance, are they going to adopt domestically or internationally through an attorney, through an agency? You know, a child that maybe has some medical issues. There's so many different ways of adopting, and they have to make that decision. And then once they narrow in on that decision, so say they're going to adopt through an agency, when they get matched with a birth mother, when it can be a very, very long wait to get matched with a birth mother, I would say at least 50%, and I would actually say more, of those birth mothers during that matched process will actually change their minds and decide to parent. And that's
50% of the time.
Oh, I would say more.
Wow.
I would say more. Actually, I would definitely say more. But that's a wonderful thing. That's the way it's supposed to be. They're getting counseling. They're making a decision. This is what we were not doing in the 50s and 60s, you know, was giving birth mothers all of these options, services. If you want to parent, this is how you can parent.
So in the 50s and 60s, society was making that decision.
Exactly.
And saying, no, Susie, you know, you're only 18 and you're unfit.
Yeah, most likely Susie's parents were making that decision. Now Susie and her parents are making the decision together. Very often the grandparents are involved. And ultimately they may end up parenting. So an adoptive parent who is going through that process thinks for sure this is the one. You know, this is going to work. And lo and behold, it doesn't. And they've maybe met Susie. And they loved Susie because once they meet, and we can talk a lot more about the openness, all that fear is gone and they think Susie is wonderful. And then Susie decides to parent and they're crushed. And they have to pick up the pieces and go on. And it's really, and they don't know how long that wait is going to be. Will there be another Susie? Will there be another birth mother as wonderful as Susie? You know, things like that go through their mind and they're crushed. And can we do it again? And often they say no. Often they say, you know, we're not going to do it. And then a few weeks goes by and they'll say, you know, we'll try again. And depending on how they've done the adoption, it could be a financial roller coaster as well.
Well, right. And we should definitely talk about the high cost of adoption and how that plays into this whole thing. Sometimes couples come to adoption after going through expensive fertility treatments, so they might want to try five times, but they really can only afford two times. I wonder what you think, too, Kelly, please, about the roller coaster.
I think it definitely is a roller coaster. I'm shocked to hear that you experience it as 50%. I think my experience with the agencies I consult with, it's more around 10% of birth parents changing their mind, but it really doesn't matter what the statistic is because our adoptive parents, that's their greatest fear, that birth mom or birth dad will change their mind. So even if it's 50% or 10%, it doesn't matter. They assume it's a possibility that's going to happen. So that emotional roller coaster is huge. And the other piece is a lot of our families have been through a lot of infertility and other types of treatments, which you mentioned, and that's a roller coaster that they've already been through. And so many of them, excuse me, have already experienced loss and grief.
They just feel wrung out.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Emotionally and financially.
Yeah. So by the time they get to us in adoption, it's how do we support them? How do we encourage them to work through those previous losses? And then get excited again for where they are in this process.
So this isn't very PC, but I'm going to ask you anyway. I know several families that have been through the adoption process, and they have said to me, we've swung too far in the other direction. We used to completely disrespect birth parents. Now they have too many rights. Birth mothers have too many rights to change their minds and be flaky and jerk the adoptive parents around. Again, that's their perspective from the, you know, from the adoptive parent. What do you think? Have we given birth moms too many rights?
I don't think so.
These days? Or have we balanced it out?
I don't think we've given them too many rights because up until they surrender, it is their baby. They are carrying that baby. They're making decisions for that baby. They have the right to do so. Once the termination or surrender happens, then it's good as gold. And then they no longer have rights, and the adoptive parents have all the rights.
And what is that window? I know it varies from state to state.
Well, it's a 72-hour window, but what happens is it takes sometimes days and weeks to get our birth parents in before the court because of our backup and our court system.
Oh, I see.
So legally, it's 72 hours, but if we can't get before a judge, it could be a week or two or more.
Caroline, go ahead.
You're absolutely right, Kelly. It has become a big problem getting birth mothers into court in order to surrender their rights. But there is a balance there, too. 72 hours is insane. I mean, that's just too short a time for a birth mother to make an informed, decision.
You're still recovering from
absolutely
giving birth and so forth. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Having had two kids myself, I totally understand what you're saying.
And in denial and depressed about everything and not sure. Mm. 2 months is too long. So there has to be something in between. You know, I think 2 to 3 weeks is pretty ideal. If the birth mother's getting counseling and she's consistent, that's wonderful. So although it is 72 hours, to wait a couple of weeks is great.
What do you think about that feeling that, you know, society keeps swinging back and forth? Before, we used to completely give birth mothers no rights. You know, you're young, give up your baby now. And now, do they have too much control over the process? What do you think?
Absolutely not. The adoptive parents may feel that way. After the birth of the child, the vast majority of adoptions now go, the baby goes right home with the adoptive parents. And until the birth mother goes to court, she can change her mind. The birth father can come forward, or if he's already involved, hopefully, he can change his mind. So during those several weeks or several months, it's agony because you don't know which way it's going to go. And we have had a very small handful during that period of time that changed their mind. In my 28 years, there's only been maybe less than 10 that have changed their mind during that period. The 50%, like I was talking about, is at some point in the adoption, you know, from when we meet the birth mother for
counseling. During the pregnancy,
right?
I see.
But once the birth mother does go to court, even if it has taken several weeks, that adoptive parent has a feeling that they could not get without knowing that that birth mother went through that process, knowing that she got counseling, that she looked at every option. They feel much more entitled and feel like the parent at that point.
I want to invite our listeners to join us, and then a lot more questions. Again, the exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'd love to hear from you this hour as we look at what adoption looks like today. 1-800-892-6477. And from Nottingham, Steve joins us. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. And I have a number of observations. First, I am an old school adoption. I am adopted, and I'm a real baby, so that tells you what I was, an SWW2 baby.
Steve, I'm sorry, we're having a hard time hearing you. A what baby?
Real baby. World War II. I was born during World War II.
During World War II, okay.
Not a baby boomer.
Okay. So, go ahead.
In those days, the parents, what they did was the state of Connecticut said you had to check the kid's IQ so you could match smart kids with smart parents. So for the first 6 months of my life, I was in a nursing home, not a nursing home, but an orphanage, and then I was adopted. My parents always told me I was adopted, but in those days, we were told you were something special, and they chose you. And I will say, I'm a psychiatrist, so the biggest event in my life was being adopted. I can also say psychodynamically, the biggest event is also being adopted, and a certain fear of abandonment, fear that somehow, like my parents live with a certain fear that I would say to them, hey, you guys were great, but I'm going back to my natural parents. So it's, in other words, I know a number of therapists that work exclusively with adopted kids because I think there is some real issues of being an adopted child.
Well, Steve, thank you for calling in. And Kelly Smith, I think after a short break, I'll ask you about that. That's your field again, a therapist working with foster and adoptive families. So, Steve, thank you for joining us and sharing your story. You can join us as well. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. More conversation in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, adoption, how it's changing, what it looks like today. We want you to call in with your stories, questions, 1-800-892-6477. What's your adoption experience? What questions do you have about adoption and how it works now? 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. Find us on Twitter. Caroline Glennon is here, Manager of Adoption Services for the nonprofit Child and Family Services of New Hampshire. Matt Mowry is with us, adoptive father of two boys, also editor of Business NH Magazine. And Kelly Smith, therapist and consultant working with foster and adoptive families. One more time, that exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, Matt, maybe you first. Our caller, Steve in Nottingham, raised, you know, some of the psychological issues that came along with his being adopted. And I wonder if any of what he said resonated with you.
Oh, it certainly did. You know, I think we have this Disney-fied perception sometimes of what adoption, especially, you know, fostering to adopt is. I know when I, you know, people learn that we foster to adopt, they get that, oh, that's wonderful. And it is. It's the most wonderful thing that happened to us in life. But for our children, you know, there's ongoing issues that stem from that. Our oldest son remembers his birth mom. And so when, you know, they were 9 months in care before they came to us. And then, like I said, you know, they've been with us for 3 years, and a year and a half ago we adopted them. So he went through a whole process of knowing his mom is out there and they can't be together. And for a 4-year-old to wrap their mind around that is a lot.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. It's a lot for a 4-year-old. And they had gone through a lot. Yeah, you know, when kids are in the foster system, they're in the foster system for a reason. You know, things have fallen apart at home. And even if things have fallen apart at home, I think part of what people think of these kids as being rescued. And that, you know, they go into this new home and they're just so happy to be there. And the fact is that they've been traumatized. And even though they have been, they still love mom and dad. That's still the family they've known. And they are the ones that have been ripped away from everything. And so...
And it's not their fault.
And it's not their fault.
But kids blame themselves,
don't Absolutely. They? And there's a healing process, and it's a long process. And we're still going through that, where our oldest, you know, had a mourn mom, essentially. And when we were working on bonding issues, our youngest, I think, was Ray, you know, for us to be mom and dad. Our oldest one, because they didn't really have a dad, I was a novelty. I had an easier time with bonding. My wife, God bless her, she hung in there because she, you know, he resisted that because he had a mom. And so for the longest time, you know, we didn't make them call us mom and dad. You know, we were Matt and Lisa. And when they were ready is when mom and dad came. We earned that. And we earned it by helping them through this process. And, you know, even to today, we have a great family. They are great kids. We are mom and dad. They're our sons. But, you know, we recently went back to post-adoptive services to request a family therapist because our youngest at 7, he was having a lot of anger issues. Mm. And he started having a lot of questions around because he's a smart kid and he started putting things together that were not quite the same as other families. And remembering that mom is out there and why is that? And so, you know, as parents, we realize that, you know, we can love them as much as we can, but sometimes we're going to run into issues related to what they've been through that we're not necessarily going to be fully equipped for. And so we went and reached out to experts because the state's wonderful, has a lot of great resources, even post-adoption that you can reach out for. And we made sure we did. And it's been a great process. We're starting to turn a corner with things. Our family therapist has been back for about past month. But, you know, one thing we've realized as adoptive parents of children that were in the foster system is that at different ages, our sons are going to have different questions. They're going to have different issues that arise with this that are going to – they hit really regular, typical milestones. Our 5-year-old is really good at being 5 right now and being very oppositional to us. he's great at it. He's pretty funny about it. But
that has nothing to do with being adopted.
Nothing to do about adopted. That has everything to do about 5. And we actually celebrate those. Even though he is being a pain about going to bed, we're like, that is so typical 5-year-old. Yay for us. But we know that, you know, he's going to have some different questions probably because he doesn't remember mom. And that we're going to have to be prepared for those things. And part of our – we've kept in touch with their birth families.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, because from what I understand, Matt, and please correct me if I'm wrong, most adoptions domestically of babies, newborns, are open in some respect, but among foster kids and international adoptions, it seems a little bit more closed. So I do wonder about the level of contact with the birth parents.
There's a level of negotiation that basically goes on. It depends on how active the birth parents have been in the whole process. Unfortunately, in our case, the parents had pretty much, even when the kids got to us, had dropped out of the picture and hadn't been doing much to work towards. Mom had been doing some hard work and some things happened, and I think it just all fell apart for her. Their grandparents have had contact and due to different circumstances could not take the kids on themselves. And so we reached a deal where basically mom wasn't going to have contact and that might be something that happens down the road when she's in a better place and when the kids are old enough to be able to handle that. So we're probably talking teenage years at that point. But we kept contact with the grandparents because they didn't have control over this. They love the kids. The kids love them. And our kids had lost a lot. Sorry.
Yeah.
So we made the decision to keep that relationship. And basically, we've got two big rules. Like, you know, as long as you love the kids and you're not bringing drama to our lives, we're good. And so, you know, it's not ideal for either side, but it's best for our kids. And everyone is focused on that. Like, we all realize this is what's working for the kids and we're going to make it work. And so, you know, it's not necessarily the extended family I would have chosen, but it's the extended family I've inherited. And we're making it work. And we've built a relationship with them ourselves as well over time. And so at the end of the day, it allows us as our kids have questions that we can't answer from before they were with us to have that connection. Or they have questions about their birth family. That allows us to have access. And eventually, you know, if that meeting with them and their birth mom happens, we have a way of expediting that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what you're saying just rings so true from everything that I have read, Caroline, that in a more sort of, if I could describe it as fluidly open, not completely open, but there's a little bit of contact that all the adults involved need to remember it's really about the kids. And that's what Matt and his wife have navigated so successfully, but I'd love to hear from you on that.
Yes.
As well.
And that was the first time I was hearing Matt's story, so that was beautiful. And
and by the way, we have a picture of Matt's family on our website.
Oh.
Just to show you a New Hampshire adoptive family, and it's beautiful. So
wonderful.
Check it out. Yeah,
thank
go ahead, Caroline.
Yeah, and you handled it all so beautifully, Matt. It's exactly what we want to hear from adoptive parents. I think in infant adoptions, there's naturally going to be some birth parent involvement. They're going to meet you before the birth of the parent of the baby. Adoptive parents are scared to death of that, and we just ask them to sort of go with it and see how things flow. As soon as they meet the birth mother, they feel this sense of relief. You know, she's a real person.
Right.
They realize that if they are lucky enough, if this adoption does go through, they know who they're going to send letters to and pictures to. There might be some visits. Visits are a little bit rarer in infant adoptions than they are with foster care adoptions, where there may have been a long-term relationship with the child. But we do have some that have evolved, and that's the key word, is evolved into more openness. So we always suggest start a little slow, do the letters and pictures, do the couple of meetings, and see how it goes over the years, and let the child sort of guide you. And many children, when they're 7, 8, 9, do get curious. And the adoptive parents, if they've had a relationship, even through letters and pictures, feel more comfortable reaching out to the birth mother and having another meeting, or in those teenage years or later on. So the openness is evolving and is such a wonderful thing.
I have heard, Kelly, from, again, adoptive parents, that there's always this question of how open is too open? You know, how do we sort of navigate this relationship in the best interest of the child?
Well, I think openness is important. And again, it's about around respect and honesty. The most important thing, and Matt, you spoke of it, is we have to attach as a family. And So we want to be involved with birth family in a way that the child knows their story, knows that they were cared for and loved. But most importantly, in the early stages of adoption, we need to attach and become a family.
A unit.
A unit. And for the adoptive kids to see, okay, I'm not going anywhere. Like, Dad's really coming home from work. Mom's really going to be there for me. And that happens over and over and over again. And that's what begins to develop trust and the attachment. And if we have grandparents, Matt, like you do in your situation, what a beautiful story. I think grandparents or siblings are important to continue to be involved so that children have a piece of their history.
How do families navigate that? What sorts of different situations have you seen from, you know, visiting on birthdays to, you know, an email once a year, he's fine?
All of the above. Mm. I have one adoptive family that I've worked with, wonderful couple. They were matched with a college-age student, and they had the baby. And they get together four times a year, not at anyone's home yet. The baby, I think, is four at this point. And they do silly things like strawberry pick and blueberry pick. And they've introduced the little boy, who this woman is, so he knows the story. But that's a four-time-a-year kind of meeting. Others are emails. There's so much you can do with Facebook now, private settings and things like that, quarterly pictures, quarterly letters. But we often don't see a lot of visitation with a newborn infant adoption.
Our phone number again for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Give us a call with your questions, comments, thoughts, and, of course, personal stories. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. And Mike is waiting in Derry. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm a big fan of open adoption. My wife and I have adopted three kids, all different circumstances, but from a parent's perspective, I'm so happy that we had the information that we got by meeting the birth parents, which helped us greatly down the line.
How did it help you, Mike?
Well, like a lot of adoptive children and parents, things don't go as well as you hope they would, especially when they get a little older. And thanks to Caroline Glenn. And Caroline, this is Mike Gibbons. We go way back.
Hi, Mike.
We adopted my son Dan through Child and Family Services, and I can't say enough about the organization, particularly Caroline. They've been there for us. My son, who is now 16, went through a real rough patch when he was much younger. Starting school, and thank goodness we had the information that we had, and by meeting his birth mother and his birth grandmother right there at Child and Family Services, and they were gracious enough to meet with us again when these issues really came to the forefront.
That's interesting. So when he was a teenager, Mike, he had some questions that you maybe couldn't answer for him.
Well, we couldn't answer everything, but we could answer a lot because we were armed with information from meeting his birth mom, who was also adopted and had some issues, and we met her adoptive mother as well.
Wow.
And it just made everything so much better. And just as a side note, some parents worry that, you know, oh, what if, how would you deal with running into your birth parent? And it happened to us. It's probably 5 years now, Dan and I were out looking for a pumpkin at Halloween time, and we drove by Home Depot, and there were some pumpkins, and we stopped, and we were picking one out. And his birth mother recognized him. She was in the parking lot, and she pulled up in the car, jumped out. She was very emotional, hugged Dan, and I just stood there and let it happen. And it was wonderful. It was brief. It was emotional, but I wasn't he wasn't traumatized by it.
Thank you for calling in, and so many thoughts and questions from that call. What do you think, real quick, Carolyn?
Wow, Mike, it's so great to hear from you. I haven't heard from you, and I haven't heard the update, so that's great to hear. I think Mike makes some wonderful points, and that's if you start off with some degree of openness, it also legally allows the agency to assist down the road, where if the adoption was closed and there was no contact, we wouldn't be able to reach out to the adoptive parents to the birth parents until the child was 18. But if it's opened with letters and pictures, you can reach out for updates on health issues, on mental health issues, on needs that the children may have. So I think that's another reason to applaud openness.
Well, Mike, thank you for calling in. And let's take another one. This is Christy in Concord. Hi, Christy. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Good morning. I just wanted to share my story. I'm 65, and I gave up my son for adoption when I was in high school. I was 17.
Wow.
And it was really the only option that was offered to me. But when my birth son was 31, he found me. It's been a wonderful trip since then. He's now 49 years old. but I think one of the things that we had as an advantage is that I was white and middle class, and he was adopted by a white middle class family. And I think that there are situations that aren't as lucky. I was in the state of Connecticut, and all the records were sealed for many years until he had pressured his parents. His parents had always referred to me as their angel, and ever since he was very little, as far as he could remember. And yet they wouldn't disclose any information about me. And when he was at the point where he was going to go to court to have the records opened, his parents did relent, give them my name, and through the internet he was able to track down various public records. My children have met him. They visited him his home and with his family. And, in fact, as we speak, my birth son and his family are visiting with my son and his family in England, where my son lives now. It's been a great story, and we have a great relationship, and I feel very lucky.
Wow. Well, Christy, thank you so much. And that reflects what we talked about earlier during Christy's era, where you're 17, you're pregnant, you know, there's no question you give up the baby for adoption. What do you think, Kelly?
Christy, thank you for calling in and sharing this story. And you're right, that is a beautiful story, and what a blessing to you and your entire family. One of the things we say today to adoptive families and the birth parents that I work with is that you really want to do, we call that a search, what happened between Christy's child and herself. We want that search to happen with the blessing of the adoptive parents. In the old days, it would be you would have to wait till the adoptive parents died, and then you would go search. And then maybe if you're lucky enough, the birth mother is still alive or not alive. Or we would sneak behind adoptive parents' backs and do it behind their backs. And that's not what we want. We want adoptive parent or parents to walk alongside their adoptive child and do it with them, to find the birth parent with them, and to really engage in an open relationship. So that's wonderful that that's what Christy's family has done.
Christy, thank you again for the call. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. In a moment, some emails I want to share with you. You can send us an email as well, exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking about the adoption process, what it looks like today, from the different types of adoption to the emotional issues that both birth and adoptive families go through. We'll talk in a moment, too, about the expense of adoption. It can cost a lot of money. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. www.adoptionsmatters.org. And Caroline Glennon, Matt Mowry, Kelly Smith, just before the break, we heard from Christy, who's 65. She had to give up a baby for adoption at 17. Finally, as an adult, her son found her. And it's an incredible story. And I feel like you wanted to jump in too, Caroline, on that one.
Having the Child and Family Services has the oldest adoption program in the state, over 100 years old now. So we do a lot of searches. And I think one thing that most people are curious about is these birth mothers who might be in their 50s and 60s like Christy, how are they going to react to getting that phone call? And I just want to say that the vast, vast majority of them are thrilled.
Really?
Very, very happy, have been waiting for that phone call. And we weren't sure how that was going to go, and that is the direction it has gone.
Well, and related to Christy's call, another listener from Center Harbor called in but did not want to go on the line, wished to remain anonymous, gave up a child 50 years ago and wants to know, how does she make it possible for that child to contact her without intervening in her life if she isn't interested? So that relates to what you just said, Caroline.
Right. If she was adopted in New Hampshire, she should reach out to the agency that was involved in her adoption. In those days, there were no private adoptions. There weren't attorneys involved. So it was definitely an agency adoption.
Like a nonprofit agency.
Right, nonprofit agency. And there was only a handful of them. Many of us have changed our names over the years. We used to be the Children's Aid Society. Now we're Child and Family Services. So if she is uncertain, if she doesn't have paperwork that leads her to the right agency, she can always go to the probate courts and they will do a search and let her know which agency, and then write a letter to that agency to do the search. If it was another state, she would go about it in the same way.
Go ahead, Kelly.
We do really encourage, though, that whether it's a birth parent or the adoptive child, that they do it with the support of a professional who works in adoption versus just showing up on someone's doorstep or Facebooking them, because it can be an emotional process and we want all parties ready and aware of the steps that happen in a search.
Well, Christy, thank you again for the call. And again, our number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Kelly, who has three questions. Here's one. Can prospective foster parents that are hoping to adopt request to be matched with a foster child that is in a situation where the child most likely won't be reunited with their birth parents? That's our first question. I'm going to throw all three out, but hopefully we can handle all of them. In terms of foster care, Kelly asks, how often are parents of infants having their rights severed? And her last question, where should a young couple struggling with fertility start in the process of learning about adoption options? I think, Matt, I'll throw that first one about foster parents. Can you say, I'm a foster parent, but I, like you, I want a foster to adopt. Could you please match me with a child who is going to be available for adoption? Can you be that specific?
I only know my situation. There are forms that you fill out, and there's a lot of interesting questions that get asked in terms of, what are your preferences, even, if you have a preference down to religion or race or things like that. We were just interested in having a child come into our lives. So we're like, whatever you got coming, we're for it, we took classes because when we go into the foster system, you have to take classes to get prepared and trained for that. And there was someone in there who had a very specific child in mind from her church that she wanted to adopt. I did run into her later, and that did not happen because I don't think it's not a cherry picking process. But I'll leave that to the experts.
Yeah. So, Kelly, do you want to address that as well?
Yeah, we really work towards reunification. That's our primary goal with the division, and we're going to work that plan for 12 months. So we typically don't go in saying, I just want to adopt. It's a foster to adopt because we want to work for that birth family and that child to be reunited.
Well, and that answers Kelly's second question, which she says, how often are parents of infants having their rights severed? Sounds like not very often.
Not very often, unless there's been an incredibly dangerous situation. like a child died or something like that.
Yeah.
We're still going to do reunification. Even with alcohol and drugs or domestic violence, we're still going to pursue reunification.
How much have you seen the heroin and opioid addiction crisis affect adoption here in New Hampshire, Kelly?
I think it's affected us greatly. I think it's affected our entire state. I think it's affected our foster kids, our birth kids, I mean our birth parents and our adoptive and foster families.
Does it mean more kids going into foster care because more parents are having addiction issues?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know the numbers. Someone from DCYF would be better to give those numbers. But I know they have had an absolute increase in their intake numbers. I also know I work for CASA, and CASA has also seen an absolute increase.
CASA's court-appointed special advocates for children who are going through the court system and have
absolutely a voice for that child in the court system. So we've had a great number.
Did you want to jump in, Matt?
Yeah. I know that – I think it was a year ago I saw a press release come across my desk that there was a gap between the number of kids that were coming into care and the number of foster family homes that were available. And I'm sure that the opioid crisis is only exacerbating that. And that, you know, and that's where there's a real need for people to, if this is something they're thinking about, to think deeply about, because there's such a need out there. There are kids that are in some bad situations that just need a safe and loving home.
Go ahead, Kelly, and then I have a question for you, Caroline.
I appreciate you saying that, Matt. And not only – maybe you don't want to adopt. Maybe that's not your long-term goal. But the division also has such a huge need for just emergency foster homes that will care for that infant that comes out of the hospital who's heroin addicted. CASA also has a huge need now for advocates. So there's other ways to become involved without saying, okay, I commit to a lifelong of adoption. There's many ways to be involved in our state.
Caroline, Kelly's third question I'd like to throw to you. And Kelly, thank you again for the email. Where should a young couple struggling with fertility start in the process of learning about adoption options?
Well,
obviously you can't answer that for everybody, but
right. I would say start with an agency. Go to an agency. You know, we offer consultations. We sit down with people. They need to sort of figure out what direction they're going in, because adoption is such a vast entity, and they need to sort of narrow it down a little bit into what type of adoption, if adoption is even the right process for them. So I would say you would want to start with a consultation with an adoption therapist or consultant and narrow it down and go from there.
Go ahead, Kelly.
Another place you can start is, regardless of what direction you go in the state of New Hampshire, you have to go through a training process. So DCYF has a training process. It's called FACES. So you could go through that process. And in private adoption, we have an 8-hour private seminar that I teach. So that would be a place to just start and learn about adoption.
And by the way, we use the word agency adoption, private adoption. What's the difference, Kelly?
DCYF is considered an agency. So DCYF.
Division of Children, Youth, and Families.
Absolutely.
So that's the government.
So that's one agency.
Yeah.
And then there are private agencies. And New Hampshire has, I believe, 5 or 6 private agencies that work very closely together. And we have a great relationship. So that would be Adoptive Families for Children, Bethany, Child and Family, Wide Horizons.
Private
nonprofit who does domestic or international adoptions.
And then there are private attorneys who will
then
also take you on.
Then there are typically 2 private attorneys, Margaret Hall out of Milford or James Bianco here out of Concord, and they will also, you can do a private adoption through an attorney, but you also have to be, though, connected up with an agency. You can't just use an attorney. You need an agency to do a home study.
All right. Well, let's take some more calls. So many comments, questions, stories from our listeners, and Lolly is in Manchester. Hi, Lolly. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi.
Go ahead,
Thank
Lolly.
You.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to give a different perspective. I'm 58 years old, and my parents adopted me at 8 months. You know, I was 1 month old. And they always told me that I was adopted, and I was curious, but never truly, truly curious about my birth parents. And then I started to look into it and was finding out more, and I was finally able to locate my birth mother via my biological aunt. And when I finally connected with my birth mother, she told me she didn't want to have anything to do with me.
Wow.
straight out. Okay. But I visited my, you know, I live in New Hampshire now, but I'm originally from Texas. Mm-hmm. At some point, I went back and I went to Texas, and I got to meet my biological aunt. And she was a very pleasant woman, and she gave me lots of pictures and wrote me this whole story. And she was just really, she loved that I had contacted her. She said she always wondered about me and had thought about adopting me herself. But she already had two boys, and she figured it would not be good for her at the time.
At what age did you start this exploration, Lolly? You said you're 58 now.
Yes. I think I was around 36 years old.
Okay. And so have you had contact with your birth mother since she said, no, I'm really not interested in meeting you?
Well, it's funny you should ask. About 2 years ago, my husband, or 3 years ago, I should say, my husband, you know, it comes up a lot. And my husband said, well, you know, why, you know the names of your half-brothers and sisters because my biological aunt had given me all of the information. And he says, you know where they live, so why don't you Facebook them?
Okay.
Well, we did. And guess what? I found them. I found my birth sister and the birth brother. And so I sent them private messages via Facebook. And so we connected. And it was a lovely connection. And my husband and I went to go visit them. And she actually spoke to her mother. And her mother was, for some reason, willing to, at this point in her life, to meet with me.
So well, Lolly, I'm going to jump in for just a sec, and thank you so much for the call. I've heard so many stories like this in the last 10 years, Kelly, about Facebook mainly, other avenues of connecting, but people connecting through Facebook and finding siblings, mothers, a neighbor of mine who's probably 62 or something. He had a similar story. It turns out he found out at age 50 that he had, you know, five brothers and sisters. So
Facebook has definitely changed the face uh-huh. of adoption. It's not my favorite. But
why really, not?
Because I think sometimes our birth families aren't ready.
Well, like Lolly's mother.
Like Lolly's. That's a perfect example. You know, it probably is that Lolly's biological mother, it was too painful for her. And to bring that back up and to be involved in Lolly's life, it was probably incredibly painful. And I think with Facebook, there isn't the opportunity for professionals to be involved, to send that letter out, to make that phone call on behalf of the adoptive person, to give that biological mom a chance to, okay, I can do this, I can get ready. The other thing, I have a lot of stories where the adoptive child or adult child just shows up and that biological mother has not told her new family. So I had an adoptive child show up on a doorstep, and the birth mother was so excited to see her but scurried her out the door because she says, you can't be here. My husband doesn't know about you.
Oh, my goodness.
But if we can prep the biological family, then we can work it. But those surprise visits just aren't so good.
Okay. Well, Lolly, thank you so much for calling in. Go ahead, Caroline, real quick.
Yeah, and I also want to say that we've had many people, and I'm thinking of one recent one where a gentleman walked into our office, and he had found his birth mother on Facebook and her family and had spent an enormous amount of time researching them and just wanted a little bit more information from the file before he actually went and did the doorstep, you know, knock at the door. And so we helped him and we found out he had the wrong family. So sometimes you can get things wrong on Facebook. Sometimes there's things in the file or that the agency can help you with. So I would caution people about going the Facebook route.
Right. Lots of people with similar names or the same name and so forth. Well, and I think we're going to have to do a follow-up show because there's so many people who want to join us and we won't have time, but I did want to share a couple emails. Here's one from Heather in Keene who says, why is the adoption process still so geared toward heterosexual couples? My dear friend is a single woman, 42, financially stable, wonderfully calm and caring, has never found the right partner. She decided to go through the adoption process on her own. I'm certain she'll make a great mom, but she's finding the likelihood of getting, quote, picked by birth families is very low. because she's a single woman. Anybody want to jump in on that? Caroline?
Well, the question I would ask is, what does she mean on her own? You really need help to get matched with a birth mother. If you're on your own, you're looking for your own birth mother, and that's a little tricky. I'm not quite sure how she's doing it.
I think what she means is, you know, raising a child
on her own. Oh, on her own. Oh, yes.
Sorry. Heather goes on to say the forms refer to he and she, ask about relationship between husband and wife, and this woman wants to go on her own and do it as a single mom.
Yeah, we've made great changes in that area, and forms were like that in the past, but it is no longer difficult, and I don't see birth mothers having an issue one way or the other, and we've placed, I think, equally.
Well, and the other thing I would say, I just taught the seminar this past weekend, and a 10 families in there, we had 3 gay lesbian families in there, we had 2 single women in there. So it really has changed. And I find that a lot of birth moms, because of some of them have had traumatic histories, they often want a single mom, or they often want a lesbian couple because they haven't had great experiences with men in their lives. So single women, gay, lesbian, anybody can adopt these days. And all agencies are open to that.
Well, Heather, good luck to your friend. And Matt, I'm going to close out with you. What would you say to somebody listening today? And we even got an email from one person in this situation who, you know, is thinking about dipping their toe or their foot or their whole selves into this foster to adopt story that you have found yourself in.
It can be overwhelming. It can be very challenging, but it has rewards. And I'll tell a very quick story. When we were preparing our oldest for the adoption, you know, I wanted to make sure he really understood. And I said, Bud, you know, when we go to court and I become your dad and Lisa's officially your mom, what will that make you? And I was looking for son. He said, happy. And I said, Bud, it makes me happy. Do you know what else that makes you? And he said, loved. And I ended the conversation there because it wasn't getting any better.
And now you're choking me up and I can't do the closing credits. Matt, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. Kelly Smith and Caroline Glennon, it was great having all of you. Thank you very much. This is The Exchange on NHPR.